Tonight on Arena, we talked to Kelly O'Sullivan about her debut film, St. Francis, and dancer Luke Murphy on his show in Kilkenny. #51551 is the text, or you can tweet at RTE Arena. It's Thursday night, and so movie night on Arena. And up for your consideration this evening, Perfect 10 from first-time feature director Eva Riley. There's Irish Interest with Jamie Dornan playing one-third of a love triangle in Endings, Beginnings. And we'll also take a look at Don't Look Down, an erotic French locked room mystery of sorts. I'm joined by John Maguire and Angela Flannery. And we'll go first to Perfect 10, the debut feature from the Scottish writer and director Eva Riley. And with a title like that, you'd be right to guess that gymnastics are central to the plot of the film, but it's also a coming of age story, John, very much out of the British realist tradition, yeah, isn't it?
Absolutely, Kay. It comes straight from Ken Loach and Andrea Arnold. And that's no harm. They're good influences to have. Eva Riley's debut feature, a young Scottish, like you say, writer and director, with another fellow first-timer, Frankie Box, playing this 15-year-old gymnast. The first time we see her, she's hanging by her thighs, upside down in the parallel bars, maybe a little obvious of a symbol of the kind of way that her life is going to be turned upside down. But what happens then, like you say, is very much hewn to that social realist tradition. We follow her in this kind of keenly observed way. Riley is very good with the camera and knows exactly where to put it. And we follow her through her life as a young gymnast in training with her trainer, with the other girls, rather mean-spirited young women that she's training with. Then we go home to the house that she shares with her father, played by William Ash. Her mother has just recently passed away, and obviously she's still in mourning. But her father doesn't seem to be bothered about it at all. And then into that world arrives the existence of a guy called Joe, another 15 or so year old, who's her half brother that she never knew existed, and the two of them form a relationship.
So let's go back to the gym. After her coach Gemma, played by Charlene White, notices Lee, this is played by Frankie Box, the central character that you described there, she's noticed that Lee has injured her hand, and she tries to talk to her about the difficulty she's having with her floor routine as a gymnast.
So what are we going to do about your floor routine?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, you haven't run it through for, what, 3 months?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, and it was working well. So what happened? Bit of a mental block. Hey? Because you know you can do it. I've seen you do it before, it's brilliant. So what's up with it?
I just ain't good at it anymore, am I?
I never said that. Why do you think I moved you up to the squad?
Because you felt sorry for me.
Excuse me, I'm not a charity.
That wasn't what I said.
If it ain't working, I can always move you back down.
Frankie Box there as Lee, and Gemma, the coach, who is on her side, is played by Charlene White. Angela, even though Lee shows talent in gymnastics, she's essentially a lonely character, isn't she, after the death of her mother? How does she take to the discovery of this brother she didn't know even existed?
Well, initially when Joe, who is played, as you're saying, by another first-time actor, Alfie Deegan, and when he arrives, Lee is quite hostile to him. I mean, they're quite aggressive with each other. I was taken aback watching it. But very quickly, she comes to appreciate his presence. You know, she's desperate for somebody to be on her side and for closeness. She just can't show any weakness. She can't show any vulnerability, and neither can he. But slowly but surely, they kind of let each other in. You know, the carapace comes away and they become siblings with a real genuine tenderness between them. That doesn't necessarily mean that all goes very well. They still have scraps, and Lee gets involved in the moped gang that Joe's involved in, and in the petty crime, siphoning petrol, stealing motorbikes that he's involved in. But through that, they find this bond that I found really moving and quite convincing.
Yes, John, because Joe has also been fairly abandoned by his father. So he's fallen in with a bad lot.
Yeah, but it's a bad lot in which they literally don't care about terribly much, so there's nobody judging her, and that's a welcome break for a character like that who's been judged all the time, either by her peers or by her coach, or entering into gymnastics competitions. So it's, you can see why she's drawn into that kind of world where they're, you know, they just hang around getting into trouble, and they're free in which to do and to do so. But this is a world, Riley puts together, that never feels anything less than real and entirely lived in. And although it does lose its way a little bit and falls into a kind of a spiral of repetition and self-absorption a little bit. But the script is sturdy enough to show us where show us aimlessness and emptiness without itself becoming aimless and empty. And, you know, if you pardon the expression, she does stick to land in the last 10 minutes or so with this film. Are really, you know, surprisingly catch you off guard almost at the depths of the emotion that she's able to generate.
Yeah, there's a wonderful scene where Lee, played by Frankie Box, and that brother we're talking about, played wonderfully again by first-time actor Alfie Deegan. They talk about their dad and why he always lets them down. So Joe begins talking here, and it contains strong language.
What's his problem?
Who?
The old man. I had a job opportunity come up in London. The boys offered me mad money. I turned it down because I wanted to come and see him. Fucking wish I never know. Has he always been like that?
He used to be all right.
I give people two chances in life. He fucked the first one last night by not even coming home. What sort of dad is that? Second one, I thought, yeah, we'll make a day of this today. Get some food on the go, have a bit of banter about football. I don't even like football, Lee. He's fucked it with me, honestly. Done.
What about me? Have I got any chances left?
Nah, you got zero chances left.
Alfie Deegan there as Joe and Frankie Box as Lee. I'm not that squeamish, Angela, but I must say, as the film went on, I had just so invested in these two characters, I was afraid for what might happen to them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Lee gets herself into situations with older boys where, as a viewer and as an older woman, you're watching it going, oh, well, where is this going to go? And you're very nervous on her behalf. And there's always a threat of menace and violence in this. But I mean, that's part of the lives of a lot of, you know, young working class people. And that's really the material that Eva Riley is dealing with here. You know, it is British realism. And that's always a theme and an undercurrent in these types of films. Yeah, and also the thing about this film, I think, is that really it's Frankie Box's movie. You know, it's a portrait of a young woman on the cusp of womanhood, a young girl on the cusp of womanhood. And I mean, she's surrounded by hostility. People are hostile to her because of her gender, because of her class, because of poverty, because, you know, she's coming from a single parent family. There's just an awful lot of pressure on her. And she plays that part so, so well. I mean, her hurt and her anger are really authentic, very, very believable. Her posture, her gait, her teenage sulking, all of that is utterly, utterly authentic.
John, as Angela said there, she's a young woman coming into womanhood. Mm-hmm. And therefore, she's curious about boys. And she's even curious about this long lost brother,
I know,
who she's
yeah.
not quite sure physically how to take. How is that dealt with in the film?
Well, it's dealt with, I think, with extraordinary sensitivity and tenderness. And what Riley is dealing with, the predominant emotion in the film is uncertainty. And she really doesn't know who she is, where she is, what she's supposed to do, where she's supposed to go, who she's supposed to spend time with. And those kind of questions are constantly running through this kid's head. But at the same time, the actress is capable of extraordinary stillness and authenticity. And that's really what's captivating about it. And that expression of uncertainty is always convincing and occasionally transcendent. I mean, occasionally Riley hits the nail right on the head, and it couldn't have been played any other way. I think it's she's a real talent, Eva Riley. I mean, on her first film. And I look forward to seeing what she does next, really.
And how many stars would you give it out of five?
I would give it 4 stars out of 5, Kay.
And for you, Angela?
Yeah, I'd give it 4 out of 5. I think in years to come, we'll look back at this and it will be one of those great British realist films. And we'd be looking at this as something like Ken Loach or, you know, Andrea Arnold, as John says.
Yeah, fantastic. So that's a perfect 10. Next to Endings Beginnings from director Drake Dormus and the novelist Jardine Lebert. The film stars Shailene Woodley as a struggling artist caught in a love triangle between Jamie Dornan as a sensitive academic and Sebastian Stan's charming bad boy. And unusually for a romantic film, the dialogue in the film is largely improvised. So she's some choice there, hasn't she, Angela, between these two hulky men. We'd know the character Shailene Woodley, or the actress, from Big Little Lies and The Fault in Our Stars. So this is it a love triangle? Is that mainly what it involves?
Yeah, it is. Like, as you say, Shailene Woodley plays, I think, the single mother Jane in the HBO series Big Little Lies. And actually, she puts in a good performance, an excellent performance there. And she's been nominated for both a Golden Globe and an Emmy, I think, for that. But she's good in this as well. But I'm not so sure about the film. It is a love triangle. It's a romance. And there is an element of improvised scripting here. And yes, she falls into the unbelievably fortunate position of being able to choose between Jamie Dornan and Sebastian Stan, two hunky 30-something-year-olds who happen to be best friends. And that, of course, is the twist in this. You know, she's kind of lost, trying to discover what to do with her life. She doesn't want to settle. Her friends are getting married. She's in her early 30s. She wished she'd travelled more in her 20s. There's an awful lot of first world problems in this film. And then the biggest one of all, which one of these guys do I want? And they turn out to be best friends. So that is the issue. You know, will she become a wedge in their friendship?
I thought her worst dilemma was that she had to live in her sister's pool house, which seems to be a shameful thing to have to do.
What a shame. After she loses her job and her boyfriend in quick succession and resolves to forswear men and alcohol for 6 months, and that lasts about an hour and a half. The next time we see her is, ironically, at a New Year's Eve party, where she meets the character played by Sebastian Stan, who's the guy with the stubble. And then a couple of, in the movie, a couple of days later, she meets Dornan's character, who's the guy with the beard and the dog. And I always find, Kay, if there's a point in a movie at which the character, one of the male leads, has to have a dog in order to make him interesting, that the film is in trouble. And I thought this film,
even though he's Christian Grey in another incarnation.
Not so much here.
What are the two men? How are they different?
Well, one, like I say, has the stubble and the other has the beard. That's about as deep as it gets.
Isn't one more adventurous and the other like academic
and deep? One is an academic,
deep?
A bookish that's, kind.
That's the Jamie Dornan
that's
character.
That's the Jamie Dornan character. He's Irish. He plays it in his own accent. And he's okay as it goes. It's just he could be more interesting. And the same is true of the other character, the Sebastian Stan character, who's supposed to be a little more feckless and a little bit more of a playboy. But in the end of the day, once you go looking for these guys, there's really not an awful lot there. And the film's greatest problem is that it presents Shailene Woodley's character with a choice, but it doesn't give her any options. And that's really where the film falls into real trouble.
OK, we'll listen to a clip now. I'm not too sure if this is one of the improvised scenes or not.
I think the whole thing was improvised, actually. Right. I think that's Dormus's shtick.
Well,
if you
this
like.
Scene is courtesy so of Jamie Dornan, who plays Jack, and Daphne, who's Shailene Woodley. They talk about Frank, the other hunk, the stubble hunk, and how he is always the life and soul of the party, even if he is a little difficult.
Frank's one of my oldest friends. I met him 17 years ago when I moved here. You know, he's one of those people, he's the life and soul of every party. He's so fun and you need him around most of the time, but then... Then, you know...
What?
He's unreliable. He's volatile. He can be messy. He owes me money. But I love him. I feel like the last girlfriend he had, she kind of drowned in him.
She drowned in him?
Yeah, I realize now that's quite a weird way of
What does
it.
That mean?
I don't know. If you knew Frank, you'd understand.
a little weird phraseology there from Jamie Dornan, who plays Jack, and Shailene Woodley, who plays Daphne. Angela, he's warning her off Jack, off Frank at that stage, but she can't deny herself Frank.
No, he's really irresistible to her, but I'm kind of laughing away here because I found these two male lead characters about as attractive as John did. And presumably that wasn't the desired effect.
No, he's swooning here in front of me.
I like the dog. The little dog was cute. I like the dog.
I like the dog too. That was about it. And I loved her earrings and I loved Frank's blue Buick, but that was about the extent of it. Listening to that clip there, Kay, really was what my biggest problem with this was. I didn't realise, as John says, that the script was entirely improvised. I thought it was just some of it was improvised. And that really was unwatchable. There's one scene between Jamie Dornan and Shailene Woodley's character that you can barely hear, and it was like it was a similar experience to sitting in a restaurant beside somebody on a Tinder date or a first date, and you're just dying overhearing how boring their conversation is and how they're going over the awful things, their awful previous exes, and
Sometimes even the conversation fades away and comes back. And the camera work also, John, is very strange. Like the beginning of the film, it's all two profiles, two people talking to each other sideways on, which isn't that interesting.
Well, a film has a number of authors, Kay, one of which is and has to be a screenwriter. You need somebody to. This film is a 110-minute ad for the absolute necessity for screenwriters. And then you have a director and an actor, and they all bring something to it, but ultimately a film is edited with the director and an editor, and that's there. Every step of that particular ladder, Dormus falls off quite and lands on his backside. This doesn't work at all, any of it really.
Right, well, will we give Frank a shot? Here, Daphne and Frank try to go their separate ways after they meet for a drink.
I love Jack, and I'm not gonna, do anything to fuck him over. I just can't.
Yeah.
You understand?
Of course. I don't need to be a wedge in your friendship at all.
It's gonna be all right. And I don't want to deal with it, but I do. I gotta deal with the fact that now I know you.
Well, you don't really know me.
Doesn't matter. I know you enough.
Okay.
Was that better written for you, John?
No, sorry, Kay, no, none of it.
So that was Sebastian Stan and Shailene Woodley. So the stars out of five for you, from you, John. I'm not expecting high figures.
At this stage of lockdown, Kay, we're not short of stuff to watch. There's no end of it out there, and this film's been released all the time. This would be at the bottom of that list of what I've seen so far over the last 6 months at home. I would give it one star for generosity.
Oh, my goodness. And you, Angela?
I think that's a bit harsh because I do think that there is a demographic out there for this film. I think if you're in your late 20s or, you're around the 30 age group, you might kind of like the clothes and you might like
the men.
Yes, and she has a certain charm, hasn't she, if a little self-indulgent.
She's able to act. She's able to act. She's not able to write her own lines, but she really does act in this, and I thought she was excellent. The lady who played her mother, whose name, I think Wendy Malik is her name, I thought she was excellent as well. So I'm going to give it 2.5.
Okay, 2.5 out of five and 1 out of 5. And finally, we have Don't Look Down, a French film from Olivier Ducasse and Jacques Martineau, set in a glamorous apartment in Paris. John, the film is set at the stage early on, five strangers come in to this Parisian apartment. What happens then?
Well, there's four men and one woman. We're not told anything whatsoever. They walk into this very chic, like you say, apartment in Paris, looking over the Eiffel Tower, as is mandatory. It's beautifully designed in these kind of neon lights. It's beautifully lit. Four men and one woman walk into the apartment. She walks in, opens the balcony, goes to take a look at the tower. One of the men walks in, opens a bottle of wine. Another walks in and goes to the bathroom and is violently sick. Another walks in and washes what looks like blood off his hands. And another guy walks in and logs onto a computer and starts watching a pornographic video. And this is the first 5 or 6 minutes of the film. And the stage is set and off we go. It transpires. Now, this is a locked, like you say, a locked room mystery, a chamber piece. I don't want to reveal too much about it, but they sit around, they prepare a meal, they drink wine, and they talk about their private lives, their sexual lives, and the incidents in their lives that have caused them most pain. And it subsequently transpires that they have somebody in common, they have an individual in common, and that individual is in another room in the apartment waiting for them to go in one by one and have a conversation with them. And that's the film. That's the whole thing, really.
Angela, when I was watching it, it reminded me a little bit, just in form, of Conor McPherson's play, The Weir, you know, where each of the character has a story to tell and there's a build-up and then the story is told and then there are ramifications from that story.
Yeah, you know, I can see why you would say that. And in fact, it reminded me of a lot of plays that I'd seen, because from the moment this film opened, I thought, this is a play, this is not a film.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that it was so theatrical. I mean, you know, they walk in one by one, the whole piece is set up, and then one by one they tell their stories. And what have they got in common? And the guy is off stage in next door. And, you know, it's a really theatrical conceit. And I couldn't get my head around this being a film at all, to be honest. I just thought it reminded me of so many, you know, when I thought about other films that it reminded me of, they were actually all adaptations of plays, in particular Polanski's Carnage from the French play God of Carnage. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, 12 Angry Men, where everyone is in a room and they're accusing the person who isn't in the room, you know, or the person who's committed the crime or the offence is not in the room, and they're telling their stories, their side of, you know, what this other person has done and how angry and hurt they are and all of that. And I just really thought, oh God, I want to watch this in a theatre.
Yeah, it's about their sexual relations with this man, and it's also about how they were humiliated by this person, how they made them perform in front of this man. So are they interesting, the dilemmas they present in the stories they tell?
I think the conversation between them around the table is more interesting than the individual stories that they have, and the dynamic that the directors put together in framing that conversation. Now, in French cinema, you're never too far from a group of middle-class people sitting around a swanky table laden with food and wine, having a revealing conversation. That's the tenet of the French film industry. It happens all the time. But to me, ultimately, it becomes a little empty and pointless. And the obvious theatricality that Angela was talking about, it and its extreme talkativeness, I mean, this is a dialogue-heavy film. It's an attempt to dramatise that process of exercising the painful legacy of abuse. Fair enough. Whether it works or not is entirely up to you, as whether you buy into the conceit. And I didn't particularly, because of the decision to keep this central character off screen. I wanted to see him, I wanted to meet him, and I wanted to go into the room with them and see what it is that they've just spent the last 80 minutes talking about.
Angela, you saw echoes of Jean-Paul Sartre in this as well, that idea that we create hell as other people, and that in some ways we create this hell for ourselves. So as much as the man who's in the room is to blame, somehow perhaps it's the individual's own fault.
That's right, this idea of helping other people. I thought the film borrowed quite significantly from Sartre's play We Clos. And, you know, in that there's three people who are apparently sent to hell for damnation, and they're expecting all sorts of torture, but in fact they end up tormenting each other. And that's very much what's going on here. And the only thing is, those characters were much more interesting to me. It's been a long time since I've seen that play, but I was quite engaged with it. And again, it's a play. These five characters, they just started kind of melding into each other. Their stories weren't individual enough. You know, and also they were all unreliable narrators in their own way, you know, like they, not because they weren't sympathetic, but because they kept contradicting each other. In the end, none of them appeared to know this guy who has, I mean, all he's really done is reject them and possibly humiliate them through that rejection. You know, there's nothing really terrible that he's done, but they don't seem to know him. Some of them say he's quiet. Some say he's very loud. Oh, he used to frequent sex clubs. No, he always brought me to the opera. He seems to have done something different with all of them. And then I think at the very end, there is a telling, which it was worth hanging out for. There is one of the characters says, well, actually, maybe we were to him what he was to us. You know, maybe he also saw us the way that we see him. So that, you know, relationships, that's just what they're like, you know.
So
that's the big question over it. Why do we do this to ourselves? That's the question it's asking.
So, Angela, for Don't Look Down, how many stars out of five?
It really wasn't for me. I wouldn't have watched it to the very end. This is my endings, beginnings, one and a half.
One and a half from you. And John?
Oh, two for me, Kay, because I thought
You're being so generous tonight.
I am. I thought it was beautifully photographed and impressively staged as it goes. Whether you buy into it or not, who knows? But as far as technically, in terms of the craft, it was well made.
Well, my thanks to John Maguire and Angela Flannery. Perfect 10 is available in selected cinemas from tomorrow, and Endings, Beginnings and Don't Look Down will be available on digital platforms from tomorrow. Sinead O'Brien has been described as a post-punk poet whose influences range from Marky Smith of The Fall to W.B. Yeats, Joan Didion and Albert Camus. She was born in Limerick and is now London-based and signed to indie label Chess Club Records and is putting her poetry to music. Earlier this year, she released this single, Strangers in Danger.
Men in parked cars drive on. Bars grow fuller and streets grow long. What's your worth in words? What worth on earth are the words? What's an unworn idea worth? What's an unspoken idea if it's unwoken? What worth do you unearth with the way of your words?
Strangers in Danger, and we look forward to more from Sinead O'Brien. Just to let you know, coming up after the break, we have an interview with filmmaker and actress Kelly O'Sullivan, which involves a discussion around fertility, women's bodies and abortion. It's frank and may not be for everyone's taste. Since debuting at the 2019 South by Southwest Festival, where it won the Audience Award, the film St. Francis has been lauded wherever it has played. Writer and actress Kelly O'Sullivan plays Bridget, a 34-year-old university dropout who takes a job as a nanny, looking after 6-year-old Francis. When Kelly O'Sullivan began work on the film, she had never written a screenplay before. Now it is one of the first films to be shown in the recently opened cinemas since the lockdown in March. And I'm delighted to be joined from Chicago by Kelly O'Sullivan. Kelly, the script seems extremely personal. Was there any one or more events that sparked what became St. Francis for you?
Thank you so much for having me. So the script is based off of two pieces of reality, one of which is that I was actually a nanny in my 20s. And then the other is when I was in my early 30s, I did actually get an abortion. And so when I was writing the film, I knew that I wanted to combine both of those very real experiences into one summer and see how they ricochet off of each other, how they interplay with each other. And then I sort of let the fiction spin out from there.
Yeah, it's a film with abortion as part of the plot. As we say, the central character becomes pregnant at the beginning of the film, and her decision to have an abortion is dealt with not as a major agonizing decision. And it doesn't take over the plot of the film like in films like Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always did recently. Was that a decision of yours to have it not as an ordinary day decision, but not to traumatize it?
Absolutely. Yeah, because I feel like most films that have abortion, like you said, it's will she or won't she? And it was really important to me that from the moment she finds out that she's pregnant, she knows she's going to get the abortion and she goes through with it. And so that's done in the first third of the movie. And so the rest of the movie is allowed to play out as it does. But it's, again, it's not a movie that's the crux of it is this will she or won't she decision.
And as we say, the character becomes a nanny for the summer. So there's that juxtaposition, I suppose, with the young woman getting to know this young girl, Frances, the 6-year-old. And then there is this decision that she has to terminate a pregnancy. Was that important that you explored the idea of motherhood or befriending a child and yet making decisions about your own fertility?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the normal Hollywood film would show Bridget growing to love this child and then being like, oh, I should be a mother. But it was really important to me to show that you can love somebody else's children and still be completely confident in your own decision not to be a parent at that moment. And so I wanted, you know, for us to always be thinking, oh, is she thinking about being a mother because she's around this child? But never to answer that question in a clean way.
Right. But it's the question is there for people to ruminate about.
That's right. Yeah.
So within the first few minutes of the film, the audience sees the female blood of the character in an presented in a rather unusual way. It's not some schlock horror thing. What were you saying by presenting this kind of interpersonal situation?
Yeah, we were trying to normalize having sex on your period, which is, you know, if you're a person who menstruates and you're sexually active, that's going to come up every fourth week. And so knowing that the something that has been shied away from on screen before, we were trying to say, one, it's totally normal. You shouldn't feel ashamed of this. Nobody should make you feel ashamed. And two, this is going to be a movie that presents things very realistically in terms of female bodies. And so in the first 5 minutes, we wanted to say, here it is. This is the movie that you're in for. Hope you stick around.
Yes, because it is, I mean, there is a series on in Great Britain at the moment called I May Destroy You, where they talk about sex during periods. But then just last week in Ireland, a tampon commercial was banned after several complaints that caused offence. It really is time to deal with, to normalise the issue, or at least to speak about normalising it.
I think so, because women and girls have been made to feel so much shame for something that is inherent to human life on Earth. You know, nobody gets here without a mother having a period before she has a child. And so it's just something that I think, like you said, it's high time that we take away that taboo and that shame so that people can just accept it as a intrinsic part of life.
So the issues of abortion are always contentious, and at the moment in America, even more so. Was it very hard to get this film made?
You know, surprisingly, it wasn't. And I think that's because we didn't go the Hollywood route. We went with independent investors, because I think nobody would have touched this movie with a 10-foot pole if we had been trying to go the traditional route of having to, you know, get people to put a lot of money into it and getting producers to say yes. So we got very lucky in that we went to about 10 private investors and then sort of made this movie on the sly in Chicago, far away from anybody who would try to get us not to make this movie the way that we wanted. So we were intentional in that way to make it outside of the system.
And was it you cast yourself in as the main character and having written it, and then your partner, Alex Thompson, is the director? Did that help make it getting the film made, or was that a more difficult argument to have with investors?
It really helped because we said we have this foundation of trust. We know the story that we're telling. It's a personal story. I know how to play it because of that. Alex is incredibly supportive in addition to being a very good director. So we had this sort of familial feel before we even went into it. And I think it helped to see us as a united front.
Let's play a clip from the film. Kelly O'Sullivan, playing Bridget, has taken a job as a nanny to 6-year-old Frances, that's played by Ramona Edith Williams. They're taking a walk and getting to know each other. And like most 6-year-olds, Frances doesn't have much of a filter when it comes to asking personal questions.
So, what's your favourite colour? Hey, slow down.
How old are you?
How old do you think I am?
52.
Why do you think that?
Because that's how Linda was, and she was as slow as you.
I'm 34.
Do you have kids?
No.
Are you married?
No.
Do you have a boyfriend?
No.
A girlfriend?
No. Do you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend?
No.
Then we have something in common.
I'm tired.
We just started walking.
Will you carry me?
Let's go back and get the stroller.
No. We're almost there. It won't take long if you carry me.
The park is really close.
You're sweaty.
So So that is the key relationship in the film, isn't it, Kelly? You there playing Bridget and Frances being played by Ramona Edith Williams. The nanny getting to know the young child and how they bond into a real friendship.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah, knowing that they would always be. I mean, to me, this is a buddy comedy. This movie is in the vein of like Abbott and Costello and the great buddy comedies where at first they don't really like each other and then they have a growing bond throughout the course of the film and have a transformative relationship because of that.
Yes, and then Frances is the child of a same-sex couple and the relationship between the parents and your character Bridget at the beginning is quite fraught because their own relationship is fraught.
That's right. Yeah, they're going through the challenges of being new parents to another child. And it was important to show that from the outside, they're a very affluent, successful couple. But once you become a part of their household, you become privy to all the vulnerable struggles that they're having in their marriage, including postpartum depression.
Yes, let's hear a clip. This is when you playing Bridget, you've been spending time putting makeup on Frances's face and then you're dancing around the kitchen and one of Frances's parents, Annie, played by Lily Mojokuwu, comes back and isn't particularly happy.
You scared me.
Y'all look pretty scary yourselves.
Mama!
How you doing?
Frances is over. I'm Joan Jett now.
Well, Joan, let's go get you cleaned up.
It's not coming off.
I think it's waterproof.
Did you use your mascara on her? You really shouldn't have done that because Franny had pink eye this weekend.
Pink eye means it got poop in your eye.
Yes, it does.
I can never get her to nap.
I don't give her a choice.
That's Ramona Edith Williams there playing Frances, or Little Joan Jett, I think, as you call her in that. And you, of course, Kelly O'Sullivan playing Bridget and Lily Mojokuwu playing Annie, one of the parents. There's a lot of religious iconography in the film, statues. Then there's even a confessional scene in a church. What point were you trying to make with those religious references?
Yeah, so I was raised Irish Catholic. I went to Immaculate Conception Elementary School and went to Mass for years. And so I wanted it to have this feel that I often feel in myself, where even though I'm no longer Catholic, all of that messaging and those rituals are still present in me. It's baked in early. And so knowing that we would be dealing with certain themes like abortion, I wanted it to always be present in Bridget's world. And then also there's another character in it who is Catholic and who has a wonderful relationship with her religion and with her faith. And so I wanted Bridget to constantly be bumping up against this religion that she had when she was young.
And those Irish Catholic or Irish connections, how far back do they go? Have you been to Ireland or were your parents Irish?
Yes. So they go back to 1847 when my great-great-grandfather was christened in Glanmire in County Cork. And so I think then he came over and like lived in Illinois. But 3 years ago, Alex and I came to Ireland and we visited Glanmire and it was so cool. We pulled in and then this like country dog ran up to us and I was like, they know that I'm home. They know that I'm visiting my home. But yeah, I mean, I definitely identify strongly as Irish American and hope to get back again and spend more time.
So this is St. Frances is such an exciting development in your career as a scriptwriter and as an actress. Are you going to try and continue down both those paths?
Yeah, I think if one is going to take priority over the other, it's going to be filmmaking right now because there's a lot more agency and control I've discovered in being a filmmaker and in being a screenwriter. I love acting and hope to always do it, but you sort of are relegated to the parts that are handed to you. There's not a lot of choice. But in filmmaking, you get to be in charge of telling the story. So I hope to continue primarily in that direction.
Well, Kelly O'Sullivan, thank you so much for talking to us. And St. Francis is currently showing in cinemas around the country.
Hey, okay, we don't have to talk about it. It's all in love. I guess we'll live without it. Hey, okay, we don't have to talk about it. It's all in love. It's all in love. Hey, okay, we don't have to talk about it. It's all in love. I guess we'll live without it. Hey, okay, we don't have to talk about it.
That was Sarika Richardson with a bare stripped back version of that great track, Don't Think About It. Her new EP, created in lockdown, is called appropriately Isolation Home Recordings. The Kilkenny Arts Festival opens today in some venues and online. One of the events is a piece planned as a major dance performance, but now with the pandemic, it is an installation in the new Butler Gallery. It's called Clouds and Boulders, Mapping Terrain, and it's the creation of dancer and choreographer Luke Murphy. Luke Murphy joins me now. So, Luke, this is a reimagined work of art pared down from its original large-scale concept. What was the large-scale concept?
The large-scale concept was to put on a large outdoor concert that would kind of feel like essentially you're going to a big music gig. So we had audience on three sides, and we had original music commissioned by Owen French and Ross Dowling and Peter Power. Really amazing music. So we were going to try and create this really big festival, you know, electric picnic spectacle, which really isn't quite feasible anymore.
And where was it going to be held?
We were going to go out in the behind the Butler Gallery. There's a garden space.
Oh, yes.
We were going to stage it there. Yeah.
So Clouds and Boulders, what's it about?
Well, the show came from, this was going to be my 10th evening length work. And I came to the composers and I said, I feel like when I look back at my body of work, there are all these kind of little pieces of work that I think might be interesting to look at again. So both myself and the composers decided to take this jumping off point from parts of older pieces and see if we related to them in the same way that we related to them when we first made them. So kind of seeing if you respond to the same idea as you did 8 years ago or 5 years ago, or if you have a completely different opinion about how what could be made from that idea. So it was kind of also looking at footsteps in the sand of our own creative growth and our process over the last, you know, 8 or 10 years.
All right. So did you go back to more recent work like Milky Boy Kid or Carnivore or Villains, or you went further back than that?
I started at the very beginning. I started with Drenched and Icarus, which were pieces from 2012 and 2013. And then it was really about taking the one or two ideas from each work, and normally physical, like really dance-based sequences or ideas for sequences. And some of them survived, and then some of them, you know, changed completely. Like all the material that was made was completely original. But it was really really an interesting process of kind of looking at where you've been and then looking at where you want to go. And this felt like before COVID happened, it already felt like a really interesting moment to be doing that.
Yes, because you've had an interesting career, Luke. I think you did a course with Michael Keegan Dolan early on in your career. And then you worked in America. Was that where Drenched came in?
Yeah. So I my first introduction to contemporary dance was with Michael when I was about 15. And that was very impacting on me, certainly at the time. And then I went to the States and I trained there, and I started working professionally in New York. And then I got the opportunity to make this duet work, Drenched, in 2012. So I started working on it with a co-production between La Mama in New York and then the Dublin Fringe Festival.
And how would you describe your dance style? Because I know I was looking at some of Drench today and an interview you did then, and it's you're a very muscular dancer. Would you think that's the kind of dance that you're interested in?
I'm definitely interested in pushing myself. I guess I'm interested in physicality, and I'm interested in being energetic. I grew up playing sports, and I grew up running around fields. So I like to kind of be physical, and I like to work up a bit of a sweat. I guess now that I've be a little bit further on in my career, it's more about finding the right language of movement for what you're trying to say in any given work. And just employing whatever medium, if it's film or text, or it's really just about the idea and just kind of doing whatever it is letting that idea guide whatever the material is, so it can come out in the best way.
So this is an installation with, I suppose, elements maybe of the set, is it? Or works in, what is in it?
So the original show, the audience were going to be raised on three sides to be looking down. So we were creating a kind of not quite a swimming pool depth, but with the audience kind of looking down on the stage. And then we were painting the floor with a chalkboard paint, so that we'd be creating drawings on the floor with chalk throughout the show. So what I've done to try and recreate that is using projection on the floor. So some of the drawings that we would have made for the original work are now, they've been animated by an artist called Gareth Gowan, and he's animated some of those drawings, and they kind of interact with them inside this gallery space.
Okay, so you're going to be performing?
Yes. This is, I'm going live performance. I'm going for it.
Excellent. So people can come in. Is it ticketed?
It's the gallery is ticketed, so you book a slot to enter the gallery, and then you have, I think, an hour to visit everything inside the new Butler Gallery, which just opened today.
Yes, exciting. We talked to Anne O'Sullivan and yesterday about the opening, and I'm sure it's very exciting to be in a new space. And how long is your performance, Luke?
And my performance lasts for 55 minutes, but the audience are kind of welcome to treat it as an installation, that they can join me for as much of that time as they want, or as little of that time as they want.
Well,
and the performance itself runs for 5 hours. So this 55 minutes loops on continuously for 4.5 hours.
Well, you're no slouch, obviously, Luke. Clouds and Boulders opens tomorrow at the Butler Gallery, Kilkenny. Further details on kilkennyarts.ie. That's it for tonight's Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGraw was on sound. And the programme was produced by Olam McGowan.